Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And I'm back from a cruise to nowhere. The Santa Rally is alive and well. 2019 turns out to be the upside down of 2018. And thoughts on 2020. All this and much more on episode number 642 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Yeah, I'm back from a week-long cruise to the Bahamas, you know, feeling kind of bloated and needing of a bit of recovery. If you've been on one of these cruises that just has an enormous amount of food and drink and fun and just island hopping and all that, and I know these are first world problems, but man, I am done. Cooked. Need to relax a little bit. Come to the office. I mean, I have to come to the office to actually relax and put together some things for the end of the year. Feeling a little bit, a little bit more settled. Because being on the cruise, it's like every 5 minutes you're eating. And if you're not eating, well, you're drinking. If you're not eating or drinking, you're getting ready to eat or drink. So anyway, I'm Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the founder of Horowitz & Company. For those of you that are tuning in for the first time, Horowitz & Company is an investment advisory firm. You know, financial planning and retirement planning, investment management. Been doing this since the late 1980s. Man, it seems like a long time. And over that time, there's been so many changes in this industry that have been just incredible. And this year is another year that we saw a major amount of changes. Some of the biggest changes that I've seen in my career with the discontinuance of commissions on stocks and ETFs from the biggest brokers, plus an enormous consolidation of the industry that we're seeing. Yeah, over the years, we've seen a push of fees lower when it comes to ETFs, mutual funds, et cetera. But now this zero cost trading, which isn't really zero cost trading. We've talked about this. The fact is that they're selling your trades to high-frequency traders, and you're hopefully getting a decent execution on this. And in fact, when you look at some of the details on some of the brokers that have been doing this for a while now, like the Robinhoods, you know, there is a cost to doing business. There's a cost to doing business with them that affects your execution on your trades. And along the way, over the last number of years, investing has become a little bit easier with some of the newfangled ways of doing investing, like online. Oh, that's not so newfangled, but it's newer than it was, let's say, a decade ago. You can easily pick up your iPhone or your cellular device and just click a couple of buttons, and there you're in. You're in on the trade. But it's also become harder along the way. And I thought I would list a few of the things that I was thinking about how investing has become a bit easier and a bit harder. So we know that we have easier access. Today we can get ETFs, stocks, funds, just on any device that you have, whether it's your portable device, whether it's a laptop of sorts, your desktop. It's easy to get information. It's easy to get into a position, out of a position. Years back, you had to call a broker that had to call their broker that had to drop a ticket, and it was a whole process till you found out exactly what you traded, when you traded, and what price you traded it. Could take, 15, 20 minutes. And who knows what execution you would have gotten. You saw something trading at a particular price, you put a limit order in. By the time that trade went through the process of a phone call to your broker, your broker placing the trade, you could have been 50 cents differential. Today, it's pennies. So a lot easier access to trading. It's also easier investing now because there's a tremendous amount and a greater availability of transparency. You know what's in things. You know what companies are doing, whether it's because of news flow, whether it's because of required the requirement of them to have greater transparency in the form of earnings or, you know, important disclosures that they are providing. The fact is that it's become a lot easier because of transparency. It's also easier because there are lower barriers to entry. If you think about what it used to be to invest in a particular instrument, maybe a mutual fund back in the day had a $2,500 minimum. Now with $10 or $15, and even with the advent of, and what seems to be really catching on is this partial shares, you know, with a couple of bucks, you can buy a piece of Berkshire Hathaway or Apple, even though the share prices are in the hundreds or the thousands of dollars. So the barrier to entry for anybody to get investing has really been reduced. And this has really taken place over the last 10 years, I would say. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, much more difficult to get positioning. So again, almost anybody with any device, because of the ease of access and now the lower barriers to entry, can be involved in the stock market, can be involved in any of the markets that are out there. It's also easier to gain overseas coverage. So where it used to be very difficult because the conversion of currencies and the availability of what markets were accessible to us here, let's say in the United States, was much more difficult because you had to possibly open up foreign accounts. And once you did that, then you'd have to convert your currency and then trade in that currency. And it was just a very difficult task. And only the largest of funds or hedge funds or portfolio managers would even think about doing that because it was so difficult. Because when you sold something or wanted your money back, you'd have to go through the process of high commissions, also of the transaction on a different time zone. Add to that, then converting it back to your currency if you want to take your money out. All these things added up. It was very difficult. Now all you have to do is pretty much just pick out a mutual fund, an ETF, or maybe even an ADR that is registered here locally in the U.S. exchanges and invest that way. So it's a much easier process. So that's really a good thing. And what we found is that that has allowed people to have greater diversification in the markets, greater diversification within their portfolios, and easy to do. What might have taken weeks or months to set up and to get going in order to invest in a market outside of the U.S. can be done in a split second. And it's also easier these days to invest as we have a Fed, the Central Bank of the United States, that's more active and more communicative because they're telling us what they're going to do. They're laying out their plan. Whereas many years ago, it was a giant secret and always a surprise. Whatever the Fed would do seemed to be a surprise at any time during their process of either a rate hike regimen or a rate reduction regimen. So what's happened is that we have a lot of things that really make investing a lot easier these days. There's probably a lot more on that list. A lot more that you could probably think about yourself too, how things have gotten easier. For those of you that have only been investing for the last, 5 years or so, maybe you haven't noticed many of the changes. But over the last 30 years, the last 40 years, the last 50 years, there's a whole different process that has gone on, making it that much easier for entry and exits from the markets, not only domestically but internationally. To gain true diversification, which was very difficult, let's say 40 years ago, to have in your portfolio positions in domestic and international, understanding what's going on with international markets, having the currency conversion issues, all the things that went on with regard to it, it was very difficult. It's all changed for the better. At the same time, investing has become a bit harder as well. You may say, wait, what do you mean? You just listed all these things that are easier. Easier access to this or that, or just push a button. But there is some things within the investing world that have made it a little bit more difficult. For example, it's become harder because price discovery is much more difficult than it was. And you have that because the Fed has induced a lot of risk-taking. Buybacks have caused stocks to move higher with no regard for valuations. So you have a price discovery mechanism, which used to be a calculable item. When you use a discount methodology, whether it's on earnings or dividends, and you look at the price to earnings growth, you look at the fundamentals of a company, and you can identify each individual company's value and then invest in that accordingly. Whereas now, because we have markets that simply move up due to liquidity in the markets, due to mandated buying through buybacks, makes price discovery much more difficult to really figure out. It's also harder because correlations have become much tighter. Again, some of this is due to the fact that there's immense liquidity in the markets because of things like lower rates and quantitative easing, and you have just a search for yield regardless of quality, and you have a rush into investments through blocks. And what I mean by that is that whereas before there were ETFs and index investing that were so much in vogue like they are today, what happened was that you would go out and you'd find individual stocks, let's say, and build a portfolio. Yes, there were mutual funds out there, of course, thousands of them. But index investing has really changed the dynamic of correlations of investments, particularly because you have such an ease to invest in each various sector. And because of the liquidity that we talked about for a second ago, the correlations are risk on, risk off. Over the last several years, correlations between different asset classes have become much tighter. And what we saw this year, for example, is pretty much a tide rising all ships. Risk was on. Virtually every asset class moved up together. Again, where you would see historically a time when you have maybe risk off, where bonds would move up and you'd see a drop in stocks. Right now, everything seems to be moving together. And that's what happens when you have a combination of ease of investment, index investing, as well as Fed liquidity being pumped in the system. Not only here in the United States, but liquidity being pumped into the system with low rates, quantitative easing around the world. And that's all creating a tightening of correlations across asset classes. It's also harder because we have this thing that we call now high-frequency trading. And high-frequency trading has made it much more difficult to find a true price discovery in advance of something. In other words, it happens instantaneously. And that really aligns right up with algo trading as well. And you've noticed this, you've seen this, where a news item comes out and immediately there's a reaction to markets. I mean, think about that for a second. How would an individual digest the information in a particular company's earnings report, or maybe in an economic report, or maybe a headline news item about some trade talk so quickly that they move markets up, you know, 0.5% within 5 minutes. Individuals can't absorb and then react to the information that quickly. This is just not, it's not possible. But algorithms with high frequency trading can do so. Computers have made it much more difficult for the individual to have the opportunity to make a decision based on the information in a timely manner that puts individuals, let's say, against other individuals in the same trade. I mean, really, if you think about it, it sets up a somewhat, I would say, unfair playing field when it comes to individual investors. And yes, I would agree that when the algos are set to buy mode, and if you're a long-only investor, and if in fact you're happy with the fact that the Fed just keeps on, you know, having a safety net and holding our risk factors to a low level, and if in fact you think that the high-frequency traders creates liquidity in the markets, you could see these as maybe making it easier to invest. But everything that I've seen when it comes to what's happening right now and how markets are set up, how the trading process works, it's made it a little bit more difficult. And this is also another thing. We have so many choices right now. We have so many choices with thousands of funds and thousands of ETFs that are out there, that makes it a little bit more difficult in terms of finding exactly what you want, because a lot of them do the same thing, especially when it comes to passive investing and indexing. How do you know which to choose? Right now, the answer that everybody believes to be the case is, oh, it's easy. Oh, I know what to do. We'll just find the one that invests in that particular sector. And what we'll do is simply find the lowest fee, find the lowest cost. That is what the big brokerage houses of the world want you to think. And what happens is, because we have an S&P 500 index, essentially, they're all created equal, right? Well, yes, to a degree that is true. But that doesn't hold for every single investment option that's out there. You have to be careful. You have to look, okay, what's under the hood of this investment? For most of us, maybe I don't want to take the time to do that. As long as it says that it's an S&P 500 or a Russell 2000 or a Wilshire 5000 fund index, well, let's just go with the cheapest one out there. And to a degree, yes, that makes sense. But at the same time, it makes it a little bit harder for us, because the choices, even though there are so many, they have been repetitive, become simply the same idea over and over. Now, once again, you could see this as, well, that's actually a benefit. Because if everybody's investing in the same thing, even though it has a different name on it, but essentially it's the same thing, well, markets will continue higher because we're just putting money in to the same thing over and over again. But as we get back to this whole idea of price discovery, it becomes a problem. It's also harder because everyone out there has a mouthpiece. You got social media, you got blogs, you got podcasts. Everybody seems to be talking their books these days. Seems to be the idea of presenting new pieces of information, new fresh ideas. Let's just all talk about the same thing. Just simply watch CNBC. Last week before I went on the cruise, I watched as I was getting ready in the morning, and every single person on there was talking exactly the same thing. Well, markets in 2020 will continue to ride up because of this and that and this and because of that and the Fed. Everybody had the same bullish attitude. Not one broke. Not one said, you know, there could be this or that happening. Or I see everybody was telling the same story. And this is something that's really changed, because even though not everybody can be on CNBC, everybody can be on Twitter or social media. Everybody has the opportunity to have a podcast. Everybody can be out there with their opinion on Facebook. And who do you believe? What do you believe? What do you know that is true? Versus maybe they're just pumping their investments that they like because they hope that their information will be seen as something very positive, therefore bringing their investments up in their portfolio. Who can you trust? Seriously. You must have thought of this. I mean, I look at this all the time. There are certain websites that people send me information on. I'm like, I do not look at that because I know that these people are individuals or maybe even professionals that are just being paid for an article, but they're not looked at by the editors. They're simply pumping their own ideas, which, okay, that's opinion. Okay, that's allowed. But it's they're pumping their ideas just for the sake of pumping their book. Everybody having a mouthpiece and social media, it's very difficult now to discern what's true and what's not. And yes, there was always opinion pieces. Analysis was always an opinion piece. But it was relegated to the professionals who they also may have had an axe to grind. They may have had a horse in the race, of course. We know this, but they were being paid and then judged upon what they were doing rather than a random individual just posting whatever they felt like posting for the sake of benefiting their portfolio. So I think this has to go in the category of it makes it more difficult and harder to invest. Because now you have everybody just talking their book. And one of the, I think the most unresolved issue and the biggest thing that I've seen making it more difficult for a lot of reasons to really invest and stay ahead of the pack is how passive ETFs, I've talked about this like three times now, but passive ETFs, how they move and impact markets and how they've done so over time. And the question I keep on asking myself is, will it keep markets calm? Will it keep the cycle going in terms of stock markets reaching new highs or at least consolidating within a range and then moving higher over time, easing the problems that you have seen historically with markets that consolidate, drop, and go into a correction, then maybe come up a bit, drop again, come up and move to the next high, then, of course, cycle back, you know, back and forth, dependent on earnings, dependent on the economic cycle, because the linkage between economics and what's happening in any particular country with their economics and what is the reality in the stock market used to be something that was really important. It used to be something that you can identify and rely on that as we saw economics moving in one direction or the other, that usually would have an impact on the underlying economy that would feed down into companies and individuals. That seems to be pretty much broken right now. And again, that has to do with the Fed pumping continuous liquidity into the markets, regardless of how things are going. We saw some of the best markets this year overseas in Greece, for example, in Venezuela, in areas that were absolutely going into recession or in recession or staying in recession. We see the idea that, well, if the economic situation is really bad, well, you're going to see the knee-jerk reaction that the Fed or the central bank of that area is going to step in and do something pretty dramatic, and therefore that liquidity flows down into equities. So that linkage has been broken, but yet at the same time we have individuals who can easily invest in an index and it will basically bring up stocks throughout the entire index, regardless of the quality or fundamentals underlying each of the individual securities, and particularly those that are market cap weighted, like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, where we have Apple and Microsoft being a 25% weighting in the NASDAQ 100 as an example. You can easily buy a basket of that because you say, hey, I want exposure to Apple. I want exposure through an ETF in Microsoft or Amazon or Netflix or Facebook. And what happens is those dollars that you put into that ETF, for example, where it goes is into those, but you also get a flush of money into all those other stocks, regardless of their their fundamentals and if you want to be in them or not, because you're investing in an index. The question is whether or not this whole move towards index and passive investing is going to, again, keep this calm and keep volatility down for markets, or will we see a severe liquidity problem into the future? And what I mean by that is when you have all this concentration in index investing and investing into these instruments without regard to fundamentals, what happens when confidence becomes a problem? Because as we know, as I mentioned, a high tide lifts all ships, especially with these index ETFs. So you're putting money into this and, you know, whether it's good or bad, underlying that investment that happens to be inside of that index, it's going to get money thrown at it. While it'll be more money going into the higher market caps and less for the smaller caps and the smaller capitalization stocks, it still is going into them. So over the next couple of years, the question is going to be when markets are reacting and you take in consideration the buybacks, which have taken massive amounts of shares off the market, during sell-offs, during a time when you have an actual sell-off, if you can remember a reasonable one, besides the one back in December, November of 2018, and let's put aside the idea of dip buyers coming in for a second. If we have a flush in confidence and confidence, you know, starts to really blow out of the markets for whatever reason, and right now we have a high confidence that we saw obviously going into 2019 from a very low confidence level in 2018. You have all these people that put money into passive investments. We have less liquidity, which could mean that we have a higher chance for volatility and deeper moves. So think about this for a second. What we saw in the end of 2018, really great example of what I'm talking about. So what we saw at the end of 2018 was a break of confidence and stocks came down almost like, what's happening here? I mean, everybody was like, why are stocks selling off so incredibly day after day after day? Almost a mirror image of what we've seen in the past few months, a melt up of sorts compared to a meltdown. Let's put aside fundamentals and technicals for a moment, and let's just focus on supply and demand. And we're going to add to that one other component. I think we need to add to the supply demand discussion, the idea of herd mentality and herd-based confidence. So last year, when we look back at this time, exact time, right where we are now, so we're at we'll call it the last week of December 2018 or so, last couple of weeks. There's a great fear and greed index CNN puts out. It was at an 8, extreme fear. Now, what happened? Well, we had this unbelievable levels of worry and angst, and people were freaking out. And why was that? Well, we could trace that back to the thought that the Fed was going to be on autopilot, right? That's what everybody said it was. Ah, the Fed's on autopilot. They said they're going to be on autopilot. They're going to raise 3 more times this year. They raised several times in 2018. And regardless of the economy, they think that, you know what, they need to slow it down a little bit because we're starting to see the hints of inflation and we see the employment rate at good levels. We see growth in GDP and factory manufacturing. All this stuff is coming in and everything looks good. They want to bring back and, quote, normalize the levels once again. So they pulled liquidity out of the system. And investors saw this as essentially destructive for risk asset pricing. You can't fault them for that, right? I mean, we all agreed that if the Fed goes too far, they slow down the economy. If what they do is increase the activity and liquidity into the economy by lowering rates and by holding off on any further bond purchases and actually shrinking their balance sheet, the opposite has to be true. So confidence waned, and for whatever reason, sellers started to hit the passive investments. There was less liquidity in the markets, and this became a big problem. Confidence was low. It moved lower. Prices were dropping. Panic started to set in. Investors said, you know, I want out. And what were they selling? Well, they're selling what they invested in. They pretty much were investing in index funds. And as the selling got going, we saw confidence was following on the downside. It was crashing. Limited liquidity meant that the impact of selling was magnified. Plus, again, what was being sold? Well, it was index funds. And it was mutual funds. And it was individual stocks. But the index funds had an outsized result, at least from what I can see, on what was happening. Because now people were just not putting money in without worrying about price discovery of the underlying stocks inside of that index. But now they were pulling money out, and therefore everything was being sold. The large caps, the small caps, the good stocks, the bad stocks, everything was being sold because you just hit the sell button on that ETF that you own, and you sold, let's say it was the S&P 500, 500 stocks like that. So we saw these massive moves in index funds and outflows that were hitting. And I guess it was a forced selling of sorts. And we got into this, what's the best way to describe it? Like a continuum loop. This loop of selling that pressured markets, creating more selling. Now, we did see some margin levels that were pretty high towards, I would say, November of 2018. And that came down in 2019. So maybe there was a lot more on leverage that created additional selling pressure, and people had to bail out because they were worried about getting margin calls. And it wasn't until the Fed clarified they're no longer on autopilot, and you know, they may have pushed a little bit too far, and that, you know what, they're going to look at the actual numbers to see where we are in the economy and maybe reverse course a little bit, because they had, you know, pushed it a little bit, that what happened was confidence once again that there was going to be a drop in rates through 2019 that turned the markets on a dime, and confidence at the same time. So we have to also add the fact that the Fed towards the end of this year started to flush in about $100 billion per month into bond buying, or QE, adding massive liquidity to the system. And what do we get? Well, once again, we get risk assets are being bought as confidence is high, especially because the Fed has all but confirmed at this point that, you know what, through 2020, we're probably not going to see any further rate moves at all, which is a mirror image of what they said back towards the end or middle part of 2018 when they were on autopilot of raising rates. Right now, they're on autopilot of not raising rates. They're not reducing rates either, but they reduced rates, and you know what? They're done. At least that's what they have tried to provide us with, that insight and that level of confidence that the expectation of what they're going to do is going to be muted through 2020. And the recent run-up in stocks, I don't think really has anything to do with fundamentals or technicals. It's primarily due to this confidence. And the reason I say that is the renewed confidence has resulted in what we call PE expansion. And you hear this and you see this all over any commentary. You know, what's been going on with the markets? Well, we have an expansion of multiples right now. What that translates to is that fundamentals have not changed, but people are willing to buy stocks on the opportunity of future value appreciation and the hope that there's going to be a long-term ability for stocks to grow their earnings enough to meet that expanded multiple. This is really important to understand. Fundamentals haven't changed. In fact, if you look and you look at what's gone on over the last couple of quarters on a year-over-year basis, what we've seen is that earnings growth is in the negative territory. At the same time, multiples have expanded dramatically as stock prices have gone up. So earnings are not actually growing, which would be the normal course of what you would expect to see this late stage in a market cycle, this late stage in economic cycle. But rather what we're seeing is a multiple expansion to a point where prices become much more expensive on a valuation basis. So the rally is thereby promoting more confidence. So we have another, I guess we'll use the same logic, continuum loop of buying now. Again, this mirror reflection, the opposite of what we witnessed at the end of 2018. And buying breeds more confidence that prices will continue higher. And because there is less liquidity due to the fact of buybacks and due to the fact that the concentration of index investing is so high, that prices even move higher. Again, share liquidity is reduced by buybacks with a much greater amount of cash in the markets because of all the various programs that the Fed has embarked upon to make sure that there is enough cash in the repo market, which they only needed maybe, I think they said $55 billion. They pumped in, I think, close to $400 billion. And they're making sure that by the end of the year, the end of the month, the end of the quarter, which is only in a few days from now, there's going to be enough money to satisfy any potential problem, and they won't have a major lockup of the repo market like we saw in September. So the question you have to ask yourself, and I'm asking myself, is this a warning from all the things we're seeing that there is a multiple expansion that does not correlate to earnings and the outlook from the economic standpoint? Or is it a green light that, well, you know what? The Fed's got our backs. And the fact is that times will get better. I think it's a great question. I think it's really something we need to focus on. So as I looked at the charts, I wanted to see a few things and wanted to look at the backdrop of the markets themselves to understand, well, are we seeing a major amount of exuberance and people buying things on margin as a good example? Well, I didn't see that. Margin's not overdone at this point. And it appears that, in fact, many investors are underinvested compared to other times in history. You know, you put that in perspective. In risk assets. So that doesn't seem to be a problem. We saw that up until last week or so, there really was net outflows of equity mutual funds and equity ETFs throughout the entirety of 2019. A lot of money came into the markets in the last couple of weeks. This after the run-up that we saw from November into December, and that vertical move that we saw recently in markets in the first 2 to 3 weeks of December. However, confidence is a bit high and valuations are stretched. I mentioned before that the CNN consumer, fear greed index indicator was an 8 last year at this time. It's a 91 today. Whenever you get past the 90-ish level, you start to think of extreme greed. And markets oftentimes will look at that and they could run on the high exuberance, extreme greed levels for some time. But oftentimes that is a signal of, as we call it, overbought. Now, it could take a very slight tick lower for markets. And there's about, I don't know, a dozen different things that go into the index. But you combine that with some other indicators that I've seen also. When you look at, for example, I've talked about this before, Bollinger Bands on the 50-day moving average, where you're hitting 2x standard deviation above the 50-day moving average for major indices. You're seeing the stocks above their 200 and their 50-day moving average, those numbers. You look at the McClellan, you look at the Spearman, you look at a variety of different indicators that are out there. They're pretty much all screaming the same thing all at once. Now, at the same time, while we have an extreme greed circumstance, again, I said margin debt is not overdone. There's an underinvestment by individuals. Confidence, yes, is a bit high and stretched. The Fed and other central banks are in stimulus mode, and it doesn't look like they're going to change that. I mean, it does not look like they're going to change that at all. right? I mean, we haven't seen any hint that the Fed or any other central banks are thinking once again about increasing rates as they saw what happened just a year ago. And as we discussed last week, I think this is really important also, many of the issues that were concerning markets have seen, I would say, a partial or a total resolution. Now, some of them that say that they were totally resolved, I'm still wondering, are they? We still have the tariffs on. We still have an unsigned, finished, completed, unsigned, undone, non-translated, phase one partial skinny deal with China. But at the same time, you have to wonder, well, the markets believe it's resolved, even though it's only a little bit. The markets are seeing this as fully, well, it's done. But what awaits is the question. There isn't much, aside from a re-flare-up of trade tensions that I see, or crazy politics, which are really possible, or maybe even the debt overload by governments, companies, and consumers that seems to be really worrying anybody. In fact, the latest reading showed that consumer debt, this is something that I'm focusing on, is eclipsed $14 trillion, the highest on record. And we know that governments hold a record amount of debt and corporations hold a record amount of debt. So between corporations and governments and individuals, we have record amount of debts being held. And that obviously explains why central banks have been so active in bringing down rates, realizing, as we discussed in episode number 624, that there's a debt bomb out there with a very long fuse. We just don't know exactly how long the fuse is, but we know at the end of that fuse that there is a debt bomb. We don't exactly know how long it's going to take for it to kind of flare into the actual explosive territory. It's also not clear how we're going to get out of this, but we know there's a problem at the end of this. And what are we seeing? We're seeing that governments, individuals, corporations are doing what? They're adding more debt. That seems to be the way they're trying to solve their problem. Pile it on, keep rates low, and all things will be fine. But the problem is, if we just look at general accounting principles or just very simple math and economics, we know that the more debt you have, even at low rates, it slows growth. You know this on a personal basis. You've seen this on a corporate basis. We've seen this on a government basis, sovereign basis, whether it's personal debt, government debt. The debt service has to be paid. And one day, sometime in the future, the principal also has to be repaid, right? And maybe that debt can be refinanced as long as rates stay low and low at the emergency levels that we're seeing now. I mean, we're at levels right now that you would never expect to see when we have growth around the world at a moderate pace, some countries better than others, employment around the world, some of the lowest we've seen in decades, stock markets at all-time highs, real estate generally booming around the world, but yet at the same time, rates are at levels that you would expect to see in times of recession. But the problem is that any move higher can and will be a major overload on the system as the debt service costs will skyrocket. And then, of course, eventually down the road, the opportunity to refinance becomes much more difficult because rates are higher. And then all of a sudden, taking that much money and having to repay it or paying a much higher cost of borrowing creates even more strain. And that's definitely going to hit confidence. There's no question that if that does happen and why we saw that major hit back at the end of 2018 and why the Fed is so paralyzed and unable to do anything but reduce rates, and that is probably going to go on for a long time to come, and why we're seeing this elongated cycle, because really there's no way out of this. How are you going to repay interest and principal at much higher rates without a shock to the system? And while this probably can be pushed off for years or maybe even decades, I don't know. Because we're told, well, there's no inflation, no significant inflation, at least here and in the developed countries around the world. And what that means and what that translates is that, well, rates can stay low for a really long time. But when I start thinking about this, and I really start to settle down and wonder how long this can last, is this going to be a new economic cycle and a paradigm that it's created? Having low rates forever and continually piling on more and more debt to solve the problems of the world, and having the stock markets go up, no inflation, at least on current methodologies to create the inflation gauges? I don't know. Maybe I've been doing this too long. Maybe I'm stuck on what was then the economic basis of decision-making compared to what we have now. Maybe it's a new world. But I don't think so. I've seen it before several times in my career, and I can tell you this. Everything cycles. One way or another, inflation's going to eventually return. How much? When? But it's not going to be an if. It's going to be a when. And until then, you're going to have growth that's subdued. The cost of repaying the debt will keep a lid on growth. We'll keep a lid on spending, and we'll keep a lid on inflation. That I can tell you. Again, this is why there's so much panic back a year ago. And when the Fed is now totally backed into a corner, not able to do much because there's really no way out of this. The fact is, you can't get out of this massive debt. Just look at a microcosm of this. Look at an individual that keeps on piling on debt and then using a new credit card to repay the old credit card for 6 months at low interest rates, then having to repay it, and they never get out of it over time. Or look at the individual that pays the minimum debt payment that they have to on their credit card, and look at the credit card statement. It will say, if you pay the minimum on this credit card, it'll be paid off in 128 years or, 87 years or whatever the number is. And you'll never get out of this endless level of debt that will always keep your personal growth, in the case of companies, in case of sovereigns, their growth subdued. So if you really think about this, there's no difference in an individual's debt load and what they have and how they can grow and save for the future and grow and expand and invest from what we see on an economic standpoint with companies or governments. I mean, it's the same thing. So I don't think there's going to be any change in the growth rates, even though we're here, because we are entering into, obviously, or in, but really starting to kick up into an election year. And you're going to hear all sorts of things. Promises of a 5% GDP growth, better than we've seen before, because we're going to cut these taxes, we're going to change these laws, we're going to do this and that. If, in fact, a 20%, 21%, corporate tax rate, a major cut on corporations, is not supercharging the economy. What it is doing is supercharging risk assets pretty much alone. Wage growth is starting to pick up, but not so dramatic as we thought it would be, even with an unemployment rate of 3.5%. I mean, come on, where's the wage growth? Where's the inflation that we're supposed to have? So as we enter this other realm, the election of 2020. Yes, this is going to be an important point of time, because depending on how the election goes will determine the extension of the rally due to confidence and the potential for Fed positioning. Now, at this point, it appears that President Trump and the U.S. government powers today are pretty much okay with deficits, debt loads, and the imbalance of spending. Even though the Republicans historically, this is laughable, have been the party of fiscal prudence or being fiscally prudent, they've seemingly opted to stick with the playbook that we have in place since 2008, which is spend, increase debt with the hopes, without a real plan, but the hopes of a wealth effect somehow resolving all these problems. So far, so good, right? The only thing we're not getting out of all this is the inflation that we expected to have, the wage growth, the growth of the economy. But, I mean, all things being equal, low unemployment, you know, a reasonable level of a small amount of wage growth, companies doing really well, the stock market all-time highs. That's what their benchmark and bogey is for all this. And I think it's impossible for us to know now if a change, in other words, if President Trump is not reelected, will bring anything different or more of the same. It's impossible. Impossible to know whether another 4 years with the same lineup is also going to bring similar results. But one thing we do know, the uncertainty of the current administration has brought certainty to markets, because pretty much as crazy as some of the things that they do, like the tariffs and some of the other things that they do, from an investor standpoint, has been really good, because their administration is really focused on market levels. Again, that's their benchmark of how they're doing. The markets are doing well. Well, you know what? We're doing what we're supposed to be doing. And they'll do and say whatever they need to do in order to hold up prices, which ultimately helps to instill confidence in investors, which is what the game is all about these days, it seems. So the question that I'm going to pose to you is this. What do you think about the next year or so? Do you think we're going to see inflation? It's going to start to peak up somewhere and we're going to find some inflation in the numbers? Will you think that the markets are going to continue to rally? Will the central banks continue to lower rates or stay the same? I want to know. I want to hear your thoughts. I want to understand what you think is going to be happening. It's not a contest. It's just information, opinion. And we're going to share some of that on an upcoming show. So you can let me know by going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on the Ask Andrew button. Put down your thoughts. Whatever your predictions are. Whatever you think how things are going to turn out over the next 12 months or so. Good, bad, crazy or not. Whatever you think. Just get this into me. We get some groupthink going on here. And better understand what you believe is going on with markets, the economy, the election, how things are going to turn out in terms of inflation, the debt load. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Click on Ask Andrew and send it in to me. I really do want to hear for the end of this year and starting into the beginning of 2020 what you think. You could also send me some of your suggestions, some of your guest suggestions, who you want to hear on the show, topics that you want to hear as well. Now, with all that as a backdrop, let's turn our focuses for a second here on 2020. Particularly, I had a few thoughts on how I see things unfolding. So let's face it, the idea of any long-term predictions right now, in particular in a time when we have a presidential election that is going to be pretty intense like this one, is very hard to do. We have news flow and headlines coming out constantly, fast and furious. And again, with an election cycle, a campaign cycle that they're going to be promising the world to us. That's what they do. So cutting through all this noise, is going to be a little bit difficult. But we try to focus on, okay, what are the things that we possibly can see? I have a few ideas on this. So let's start. January. Number one, January. And we've seen this before, the idea that, you know, we see oftentimes a big move on the Santa rally and then somehow a bit of a dip and a destructive force that happens, well, we'll call it mid-January through February, where markets could, let's say, see a 5 to 10% decline in index prices. I think there is a high probability of that because of the rush to put money to work towards the end of this year. I wouldn't be surprised about that, especially if there's a rotation and rebalancing that takes place. It doesn't look like there was much more than this multiple expansion through the end of the year by trying to, you know, catch up a little bit towards the end. And I think that possibly we may have seen a pull forward in expectations with the Fed, you know, being so active, putting so much money to work, et cetera. And if all goes smoothly for the end of the year, where the repo markets are really not infected and we did have enough liquidity, they may actually slow down and stop their market operations and slow them down considerably. Number two, next up, value style positioning. And we talked about this over the last year or so, and we've discussed the potential of a move towards value, right? Towards value from growth, especially as this spread has been widening between the returns of value-oriented investments and growth-oriented investments, and how growth has been outperforming by a ginormous margin. I mean, just an enormous margin growth, right? So we've been seeing this, and over history, again, we've seen this cycle ebb and flow, and we've seen that when there's too much of a move on one side by value or growth, sometime in the future, there's a bit of a payback where you see the rotation that moves back into the other side and we start to get a reversion and a trade that either means that in this case, growth will come down much greater than value in a correction, or during a time of just regular market activity, value outperformed dramatically, catching up to the 2 or 3 year lag it had over time. So I think that there is this opportunity, particularly because while we were a little bit early in this, from a risk return standpoint, the overweighting of value, it seems to make a good deal of sense. That does not mean that we would take our portfolios out of growth entirely, because that's just not a smart move. You don't want to bet on one side versus the other in a well-diversified portfolio. That's not the way you do a good level of portfolio management. But overweighting the value side of the equation, well, that could be very beneficial. And especially if we are seeing that multiple expansions, particularly for the growth side, tech and healthcare, have been on fire, moving so dramatically. Something to think about. Number three, international versus domestic. You've been hearing a lot about this. You heard this probably in the beginning of this year as well. But if you don't have much in the way of developed or emerging stocks in your portfolio, this may be something you want to consider this year because, again, on a relative basis, they are at a valuation that is very much depressed compared to the U.S. counterparts. And when you look at that and you start thinking about cycles like we did with value and growth and reversionary trades, there's something to really make of that because even though we are seeing that there is a slowdown in the international markets, they're about a year and a half ahead of us in terms of their slowdown. If, in fact, we see a slowdown here, again, we may, in fact, see that stock come back to normalized levels of price earnings and of valuations, and their stocks, either in the international emerging, may not do as badly, or you may see this reversion trade as investors are looking for better value. And in particular, if the dollar continues to maybe soften a little bit, as we've seen over the last month or so, where the U.S. dollar since October has fallen about 2% and the emerging markets index about 10, while the S&P is up about the same amount, emerging markets trail the S&P by 15% this year as the U.S. dollar went up 4%. The dollar has a big impact, particularly on emerging markets. And I think that if we see the dollar start falling, for whatever reason, there could be some real nice returns inside of the emerging market space. Number four, fixed income. I've talked about this before. I'm sticking by it. Once again, shorter durations and maturities make more sense. Shorter durations or low duration, shorter maturities, because it doesn't seem to be beneficial to go way out on the yield curve to achieve only a very small amount of additional yield. Rates on the 30-year treasury have gone from about 3% at the start of this year to a low of about 1.9 in September, kicked back up to 2.3% where we are now. Rates on the 10-year are 1.87%. That means that going out 20 years on the curve gives an additional 40 basis points per year of return with much more potential volatility. Does that make any sense? I don't think so. Number five, tech and healthcare. We're going to see a lot of campaign promises being made over the next year. They're going to be escalating the closer we come to the election. And this is a potential hotspot. potentially an area we're going to see a lot more volatility depending on who leads the Democratic race. Because we've had talks of breaking up the big companies and all sorts of plans to do, you know, harm to healthcare companies because they're making too much money. This may provide some outsized moves in this area, especially because we've seen such a run-up this year and outsized gains in this sector. So I think you really have to watch this in the second to third quarter of 2020, maybe the second quarter, as we gain more clarity on who the Democrat Democrat front runner will be. And finally, commodities. So commodities have had a decent year this year, which is much different than we saw the last couple of years before, because we had some real subpar returns and we're starting to see the potential for a rotation into this broad sector. Now, I'm not talking about just gold or just oil. I'm talking about oil and ags and metals and, you know, everything related, natural gas for that matter. If there is some inflation or maybe even a safety trade that kicks up or the realization of a bottoming process for the global economies, commodities may be a decent diversifier within the portfolio. So there's six items that I'm looking at for 2020 as some themes. Just a few to consider. Some of these areas may be best invested through, let's say, ETFs. Others may be mutual funds. Actively managed mutual funds. Well, it depends on the sectors and the asset classes. So just to be clear, these are just observations, initial thoughts worth considering as the year goes on. I'm going to have some clarity on some of these. Not a recommendation necessarily, just understand that. You know, but I will give you a recommendation here. We're approaching the end of the year, and it's a time to take a close look at your portfolios, make sure that you're diversified in a way that matches your risk tolerance and your time horizon. It's essential to take a look. You know, don't spend more time on figuring out what you're going to watch for TV tonight or what you're going to have for dinner than you spend on your portfolio all year long. You need to make sure you have style diversification, trading diversification. And I think it's really important, this is a bit cliche, that you need to be able to sleep at night with your holdings. So far this year, it's like, okay, we had a couple of dips here and there. Nah, big deal. Dip buyers came in. There's a lot of money in the sidelines. Not much happened. And this is kind of simplistic, but I can't tell you how many people I see that come to us with positions they're holding with no understanding of what they have or how it relates to their goals. So as we enter this new year, a new decade for that matter, let's take some time to explore and review how you have your holdings set up for the future. And this includes things like your 401k, your retirement plans overall, your personal holdings. Take the time to review the outlook, add some diversification, because we've seen one of the best decades in history for risk assets. And is it going to continue? Possibly. But as I've said, everything cycles. And keep a lookout for the next opportunity for the next year, for the next decade. Oftentimes, it's not going to become clear for some time, and then all of a sudden, it's just right there in your face. So it's really important this time of year, take this as my wish for you for the new year. To as we go through the next couple of weeks, as the new year starts, spend a few minutes with your portfolio. Make friends with it. Shake hands with it. Understand what it is that you hold, how the different investments work together, and how it's aligned with your risk time horizon for your future goals. I want to wish you and your family a happy and a healthy new year as we're lining up some great guests with some great content, great shows for the coming year, so stay tuned. And don't forget to send in your thoughts and your outlook for the year ahead. Go over to The Disciplined Investor, click on Ask Andrew, and send it on into me. Until I see you again, which will be next year, the year 2020, with the next show, I want to wish you a happy and a healthy, a wonderful time. Love and the best. Thank you for making this year so successful for the show. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged. We have some best ofs coming up over the next couple of weeks. And I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, The information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.